Right, I've forgotten how to do this. I used to do podcasting about a decade ago. Things have moved on a bit, haven't they? Everyone's podcasting now. So, thought I might get back on the train. I am Richard Hall. I work at De Montfort University in Leicester, in the UK. I've been writing about life inside the university in general for a while now. That's all come together. In a recent, well, it's all come together in one way. In a recent book with Palgrave Macmillan on academic alienation. So the book's called The Alienated Academic: The Struggle for Autonomy Inside the University. Rather upbeat. The point, I guess, for me is to focus upon the individual and her communities, her networks, as the unit of analysis. Rather than focusing on the university or the education sector of the economy or whatever the hell it is that management and politicians want us to focus on, or even the fetishization of the student experience. So, the point of the book, I guess its rationale, was to effectively look at academic work from the perspective of the academic labourer. In a way that will really please everybody, it takes, I guess, an open Marxist approach to this, a kind of a humanist Marxist approach to this, by thinking about the way in which Marx's early work on alienation in economic and philosophical manuscripts and the Grundrisse get taken forward or might be used as a heuristic for thinking about academic work in terms of. Academic commodities and academic knowledge, in terms of the profession as a whole, and in terms of the labour power of the academic, in terms of the impact on the individual academic, and I focus here on a kind of concept of Weltschmerz. So there's, I can't pronounce that. Well, how do you pronounce that? Well, Weltschmerz. It's, kind of that sense of ennui beyond world weariness. Your kind of sense of utter abject hopelessness. So I'm really interested in what academic work has done to the individual sense of self of the individual member of staff, the individual academic, and also then thinking about what academic identity means more broadly. So what does it mean when we're perpetually spun in competition with each other through discourses of enterprise and employability and impact and excellence and all that jazz. So, I'm interested, I guess, in the book in thinking about Marx's early work from a kind of a philosophical perspective, a humanist perspective, thinking about the construction of the academic, and also then carrying that through to kind of Marx's later work, thinking about alien labour, estrangement, separation, divorce. Commodification of, well, every moment of the experience of the academic, from the engagement with students, the student experience, the production of knowledge, knowledge transfer, knowledge exchange, research impact, our relationships with our peers, which are being commodified and placed into competition through league tables, all of that kind of stuff. So I'm interested in that. And in the book, we situate this against, I don't know why I said we, it's me. I situate this. No, it's we, because as I'm clear in the acknowledgements, this is a thing that is, the genesis of this thing is my own experiences and the experiences of my kind of peers and friends. So I relate to them or refer to them. Also, people who have been writing about this stuff forever, because there's a long lineage of writing about academic labor, there's novels about academic labor. There's a whole series of stuff about unbundling the institution, people writing about the point of higher education, with lots of status-related societal anxiety about this going back decades. So I write about this really from the perspective, I guess, in the book of academics wanting, I'm not sure that's what they want, they needing, which is a bit of a projection of mine, isn't it, onto the academic. To become awakened to the nature of their labour, that it is not, that it's cast as a labour of love but it is way worse than that. That alleged avowed love is turned back upon the academic in order to extract ever more labor power, ever more work from her. That this has a series of ramifications in terms of proletarianization, in terms of overwork, in terms of issues to do with ill health and anxiety that we've been hearing about from a range of people on blogs, also in peer-reviewed work, at conferences, in particular, own water coolers when we're undercommonsing the institution in trade union meetings. So I try and relate this idea that academics might become awakened to the reality of their existence and that their work is no longer a craft, it is a service, that we need to consider that work in the way in which it is being increasingly commodified in the face of issues to do with competition and productivity, the Treasury's drive to instantiate competition across all sectors of the economy, including those that are notionally public, and that there are the ways in which that notion of commodification, productivity through commodification, is being sort of revealed through financialization, through the market, through private property over things like knowledge exchange and knowledge transfer. We need to kind of analyze that in light of a crisis of capital and the way in which a kind of long depression that has kind of impacted since 2007 and the collapse of Lehman Brothers has folded, as we've seen through a politics of austerity, has folded the university into more firmly into the kind of the circuits of capital. And clearly, the university was always a node in capitalist reproduction. It's just it's become a little bit more accentuated, amplified, and all of those kind of wider societal issues to do with labor rights are now being felt inside the institution. We're no longer inoculated or inured from this. I go on to sort of discuss that or try and contextualize that in terms of the history of alienation, and there have been ebbs and flows in terms of the engagement with alienation in the literature. A lot of work done in the sort of 50s and 60s, and then through the 70s in terms of the collapse of the kind of the beginning of the collapse of that sort of Keynesian compact post the war, that kind of rise of sort of neoliberal governance that follows the collapse in Bretton Woods in the early 70s. Try and theorize it in terms of kind of issues. I guess that sort of flow from Feuerbach and Hegel through through to Marx, and then later kind of thinking about alienation across this kind of social terrain, and trying to think about it in terms of work, I'm trying to think about it in terms of estrangement and separation, in terms of commodity fetishism, in particular. Trying to think about it, I guess, I'm very influenced by John Holloway's work here. His work on kind of on the fetish, on the idea of the commodity, on the idea of wealth, what capitalist social reproduction means for our ideas of wealth and how they then infect the university, and how they're presented in other ways, how they're presented around the student, how they're presented around academic autonomy or free speech or whatever it might be, but how actually that has become perverted and doubles down on the academic herself. So then I go into talking about these issues to do with knowledge production, the idea of the profession, the idea of, I'm not going to pronounce Weltschmerz, but that thing, well, I should have done German, it's terrible. And also that idea of the academic identity to try and get a sense of that kind of interrelationship between the reality of what the academic produces, including her labor power. And what she sells, pivoting around her alienated labor power, and the interrelationship with her sense of self and her peers, and how those are increasingly divorced or separated from her. This kind of leads into two final chapters, because I always have this kind of thing that a lot of academics have, which is that, I'm going to critique and critique and critique and criticize and all of that jazz, and I can kind of analyze why things are broken, but I can never suggest how we might move beyond. So I decided that there wouldn't be just one final chapter working for or pushing towards another world being possible, but there would be two, and the first pivots around indignation, because as a kind of an opposite to dignity, and dignity is the thing, isn't it? How do we find dignity inside a world that is increasingly dehumanizing? So I speak about indignation because change can begin from indignation. And also that indignation pointing to a range of other perspectives, and I'll come back to that in a second. And on the in the last chapter, trying to think about ways in which we might push across a social terrain for autonomy, that this cannot just exist inside the university, and that the university as it currently exists needs to be dismantled before it can be abolished. And that's fundamental. Now, I make a specific point about joining to other voices and other narratives because my own position as a white heterosexual male professor in an established institution comes with a whole set of narratives around it, a whole set of capitals wrapped around it. And I don't think we change the world by listening to the same voices that got us into this mess in the first place, and they are ostensibly white, male, ableist, heterosexual, cisnormative. So I'm interested in listening to voices that have been made marginal, from whom we might be able to learn. And in particular, because a lot of the people who are at the core of a system that has been alienating are now feeling the effects that have been implemented on those who have been made marginal over time. So all of a sudden, we can kind of see what has been happening to those individuals and those groups, and what they have been made to, how they have been made to behave, or how they have been labeled. So in this, I've taken a lot from the work of people like Audre Lorde and bell hooks and Sara Ahmed, amongst others. So I'm trying to think about intersectional issues. I'm trying to think about queer issues and feminist issues. I'm trying to think about Black Lives Matters without kind of co-opting any of these things, but again, attempting to, in my own head, work my own space out in relation to these issues. So, in the context of this podcast, which might turn out to be an ongoing series of engagements with people, I'm interested in taking the kind of theoretical position that I have developed in the book and understanding the lived experience, or a range of lived experiences that challenge me in the way in which I live inside the university, but also outside, because I'm involved in a few other things externally, a couple of education co-ops, the Social Science Centre in Lincoln and Leicester Vaughan College, which both have a kind of an adult education andragogic purpose, that are developing alternatives to the current model of higher education, or attempting to do something different at least. So I'm interested in challenging my own perception and my own moment inside the institution, and I think that I need in that moment to be working with or talking to people about their intersectional experiences, their precarious experiences, their othered experiences, their mothered experiences. Actually, what does it mean to be a carer, a mother inside an institution that demands that you perform in certain ways? I'm interested in issues of ill-being as opposed to well-being. I'm interested in what does resilience even mean? I'm interested in what do indigenous struggles and lessons from international struggles, what do they have to tell me? Also, what are struggles, stories of struggles, narratives of struggles from other service sectors. What do they have to tell me and us about what might be possible inside the university as a precursor to dismantling the university and abolishing the present state of things? So I'm very much interested in alternatives, and those might be in relation to issues like precarity, or issues like Black Lives Matters, or Roads Must Fall, or Indigenous struggles. But they might also be in relation to specific interventions in the UK, things like the Research Excellence Framework, or the Teaching Excellence Framework, or the Knowledge Excellence Framework, or even discourses around enterprise, employment, and employability, impact and excellence, which completely dominate our narratives and our lives and our lived experience inside the university. So I'm interested in all those things. I'm going to try and talk to a few people about those things, see where we go with it, see if we can come up with anything, which might be, how do we think about recovery? How do we think about staying safe? How do we think about mutuality and solidarity? How do we think about being courageous and faithful and looking for justice? Is there a space for hope? Can we find some peace? All of those things in a very humanist way. I'm interested in the recovery of dignity and is that possible inside the university through alliances with professional services staff and their unions and with students and their unions and with their families as well, in order to define something different? And can this then be done at the level of society? Can we, because we don't reinvent the university from inside the university. In fact, we don't reinvent higher education from that space. We only make it, in the current state of things, more capitalist and more value-oriented and more alienating. So I'm interested here in working at the level of society and what might the social strike mean, and what might, for instance, developments like the cooperative university, what might that mean as a node on a pathway towards something different, towards another way of defining or constructing society. Now, part of this, I guess, is going to be conditional on people wanting to talk, and a lot of people are scared. There's a lot of fear of voicing who they are, where they're from, what they're doing, about talking about their actual experiences inside their places of work, because those places can be extraordinarily performance managed and disciplinary. And so there's a fear of voicing, and yet voice is so important. No, I completely get that silence can be a weapon and silence can be a defense, and silence is really important for some people. But equally, I'm hoping that we'll be able to develop some voices here that build some kind of collective solidarity. So that's my hope, and we'll see how it goes, won't we? I'm hoping it will be relatively upbeat as well, because the last thing we want is another dour Brummie telling us that we're all doomed. So I will see you soon. You all take care.